Hi everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, the Geek Show's dedicated comics and manga podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today is Mick.
Hello!
And no Andrew. We're free, and Mick!
We are free, but on a serious note, Andrew was last seen fighting off an invasion of highly dangerous Kryptonian Skrull hybrids.
Whoa. Is there some weird DC Marvel crossover happening again?
Probably.
The Crypto Skrulls.
The good news is that the invasion was thwarted, and the bad news is Andrew hasn't been since. But hey, Andrew, we love you 4,000.
Why isn't there 3,000 anymore? Well, inflation.
Because Andrew's more important than Tony Stark.
I just thought it was inflation.
Oh, hold on a minute. I've just had a postcard from Andrew. He's in bloody Italy. He lied. The scumbag.
Anyway, enough about postcards from the Edge. We're talking live action.
I've got one from Bono as well.
Is this in between his kneeling?
Probably.
Anyway, yeah, live action TV shows based on comic books. There's a lot of them these days.
Hold on. Oh, where did that intro come from?
I'm just segueing hard here.
That wasn't a segue. That was a cut.
It was an amateur YouTube video cut.
I mean, normally what happens is one of us asks, what are we covering this week? And the other one answers. You just segued straight into that.
I did just pass my driving test.
Oh, congratulations. It's no reason.
I didn't
just,
really.
Just because you passed your driving test doesn't mean you can steamroller the intros. Hey, do you see what I did there?
Yes, I did. Anyway, we are talking live action comic books based on, live action TV shows based on comic books. And Mick.
Yeah.
Where do we start?
Well, I think we start at the beginning. Let me take you back.
Oh, God, no. Oh, God, no.
Let me take you back to the early 70s.
Oh, no.
And a young boy.
No, it was even before then.
A young boy who lived in a cultural wasteland. Because to watch his favourite comic book heroes brought to life in any way, shape, or form, he had a choice. He had the 1966 Batman series, and that was it.
Or the 1950s Superman series.
No, because it never got shown when I was a boy.
Has anyone actually seen that?
I've seen it since, but it wasn't one of those that got constantly rerun. I mean, the Batman 66 series probably got rerun end to end on a Saturday morning for about 5, 6, 7 years after it was cancelled by NBC.
I mean, that original Adventures of Superman, though, from 1952, it ran for 6 seasons.
Yeah, I know, but I don't know whether it's because it was in black and white or whether it's got that whole missing episodes thing that happens to a lot of 50s and 60s shows, I don't know. But it just never figured in the viewing landscape. But that's my point. Back then, live-action superhero or comic book shows, that was it, basically. You had 66 Batman on reruns. You had, if you were lucky enough to get it, the 58 Superman series. But live action stuff, there was a 1940s Batman as well that occasionally you get the odd episode of shown as part of some kind of comic book special.
Yeah,
but I mean, very rarely.
It wasn't until the mid 70s when you started getting a lot more live action superhero stuff. But before then, because, I mean, the next one to turn up after Superman and Batman, it was Shazam, and I think it was on the Marvel front, Spider-Man, was it?
Yeah, well, what I was going to say was that over the years, up to comparatively recently, live-action comic, I mean, there's always been cartoons.
Yeah.
And we could probably do a whole special on the cartoon stuff.
Yeah, but that's a separate discussion.
The live-action stuff was sporadic. Both in quantity and indeed in quality.
Except for but 1977 Incredible Hulk.
The Incredible Hulk was good Marvel TV. The Amazing Spider-Man starring Nicholas Hammond...
Was not.
Was not.
What about The Amazing Spider-Man from the Toei Company, which was 41 episodes and a film in Japan?
I can't comment because it was shown in Japan.
I can, and it's glorious in how terrible it is. Spider-Man has a giant robot.
But it's still better than the Nicholas Hammond one. Because everything in the world, with the possible exception of Inhumans, is better than the Nicholas Hammond Spider-Man.
True, true, true.
On the DC side, we did have The Adventures of Wonder Woman.
Yeah, we had Shazam Secrets of Isis in The Adventures of Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
And then a weird one in, like, the late 80s. On the Marvel front, there was a massive gap of, like, 20-odd years with no live-action TV shows. And on the DC front, it was late 80s. They had that weird Superboy series.
Yes. And I think this is the thing. DC seemed to have been more prevalent on the small screen and more successful on the small screen, arguably, than Marvel.
Yeah, I mean, the small screen outings, there was Superboy, Swamp Thing. Swamp Thing actually ran for 3 seasons originally.
Yeah.
The Flash. Then in, like, the mid-90s, there was Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, which most people have at least heard of in some way, shape, or form.
And I think that that was probably the one that broke the mold. I mean, obviously, you sort of 66 Batman, that kind of stuff. It was aimed at that sort of Saturday evening action adventure.
Yeah.
Sort of kids, early teens slot. But I think Lois and Clark was probably the first one that crossed over. And because of that focus on the relationship between Lois and Clark, I think a lot of non-comic book fans watched that.
Yeah. The biggest series for DC so far is Smallville.
Yes.
10 seasons. I mean, quite a lot of people were into Smallville. And yes, okay, it's the Superman story or a new take on the Superman story. But people liked it because it didn't focus on the punching of other supervillains and solving problems by punching them. It focused a lot more on kind of the character interaction, which I think people liked more.
Yeah, and I think it was a bit DC 90210.
It was very much DC 90210.
But I think you had an engaging Lex Luthor, and it was interesting to put that spin on of them being sort of boyhood friends.
Yeah.
Especially with the sort of machinations of Lex's dad and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
And it did go off the rails a bit, I think, in seasons 9 and 10. It went a bit awry.
Yeah.
And it did, of course, lead to the ill-fated Aquaman spin-off.
Yeah, we don't talk about that.
Which only got as far as the pilot.
I told you, we don't talk about that. I will say, the list of pilots is actually pretty interesting. Do you want to know some of them?
Okay.
The pilot episodes. So, in order, from 1958, The Adventures of Super Pup. 1961, The Adventures of Superboy. These are all the DC ones. 1967, Who's Afraid of Diana Prince? 1968, Batgirl. 1974, Wonder Woman. 1990, Human Target. 1997, Justice League of America. That was unaired in the US as well.
But Human Target went to series.
Human Target went to series. These are just the pilot episodes. The Aquaman one from 2006. It was Global Frequency in 2005. Another Wonder Woman TV series pilot in 2011.
There was with Adrian Padalecki.
Yep. And then there was...
whatever her name is.
Then there was Sculpt in 2017 and Secret Six this year.
Yeah.
So there's been a few pilots. They've had a few ideas.
Yeah.
Marvel, on the other hand, have very much been out of the loop when it comes to live action TV shows. There was Mutant X, which nobody really wants to talk about because it was basically knockoff X-Men.
And it's a shame when Marvel are having to do knockoff X-Men.
Yeah. That was in 2001, and that ran for a few seasons. And then there was Blade, which ran for one season, and that was 2006. Yeah. And then after that, there's like a 10-year gap until you get to the first Avengers movie, and then you have their first actual full-on live-action TV show, Agent Carter.
Yep.
Which then spawned Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage.
Actually, no, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. came before Agent Carter.
Did it? Oh, yeah, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was 2013, wasn't it?
And still running.
Yeah. It's interesting because Marvel haven't really done as well as DC have when it comes to TV shows. Because DC, on the other hand, 2012, you had Arrow. Then 2014, they brought back Flash, and that is still going. Both those shows are still going.
And yeah, I mean, Arrow's going to come to an end with this forthcoming season that starts at the end of the month.
Yeah. And then you had Supergirl in 2015, which is still going on. DC's yep. Legends of Tomorrow, which is still going on. Black Lightning, Titans, DC Daily, Doom Patrol, Pennyworth. And those are all eminently watchable shows.
Yeah. I mean, Pennyworth's first season has just come to an end. And it is the most bizarre comic book show from the mainstream sort of universes that I think I've ever seen. It makes elements of Gotham look logical.
By the same
but it's got
token,
Paloma Faith punching yeah. people, so that's all right.
Well, yeah, what's not to like about that? But here's the thing. Marvel, by the same token, haven't fared as well. Agent Carter Season 2 was really nothing special. Daredevil no. Season 3 wasn't that good. Jessica Jones Season 2? Luke Cage, not... second season?
Jessica Jones Season 2 wasn't as good. Jessica Jones Season 3 was better than 2, but not as good as 1.
Yeah, Luke Cage Season 2, not as good.
The Defenders... Well, it was exactly the same, let's be honest. It was basically Season 1 with a different villain.
Exactly, which made it automatically not as good. Iron Fist, do we want to talk about Iron Fist? No.
No.
Legion is always worth talking about, but that seems to be the... Legion had a lot more interesting stuff going on. It was kind of detached from everything else. Inhumans, we don't talk about Inhumans. The Defenders.
Let's not talk about that either.
Punisher, Season 2, not as good as the first season.
No. And I think that was the problem. All the Marvel Netflix shows had really strong opening seasons.
And then kind of trailed off, didn't
they? Apart from Iron Fist.
Yeah. But then they just kind of trailed off as if they basically said everything they wanted to say, and they were just like, well, you know, I don't know what to do right now. So it's like that, you know, that kid who's basically sung his heart out, but everyone wants an encore, and he's still on stage, like he's got the mic.
But he only knows the one song.
Yeah, he only knows the one song. That's what all these shows are like.
Well, that's it. And you look at it, and, you know, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which has its detractors.
Yeah,
and it has lost its way on occasion over its 7 seasons, but it's still there and hanging in.
There's a reason for that, but we'll get to that in a second, right? We'll get to that in a second. I do want to point out two other Marvel shows. Runaways and
yes.
Cloak and Dagger. Now, Cloak and Dagger, I tried watching and I was just like, oh.
Yeah, again, that's a bit more Marvel 90210.
Yeah. Runaways, which should have been a bit more Marvel 90210, was a bit more fun.
Yeah. And I think the sad fact is, with Runaways, I think if anything happens to Runaways, it'll be more down to the popularity of Hulu as a streaming service rather than Runaways itself.
Exactly. Which brings us back to what I was going to say about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., right?
Yeah.
See, I think the key thing about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is the fact that its focus isn't on the superheroes. And
yes.
I actually think that that allows it so much more flexibility with the stories it can tell. Because at the end of the day, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., from everything I've watched of it, is kind of like, okay, we live in this world of superheroes and supervillains, but every day our job is still to be the X-Files.
Yeah, it kind of is. I mean, you say it doesn't focus on the superheroes. You have got Daisy Johnson as Quake, and you've got...
Yeah, but they've come in recently. They weren't there in the first two seasons, were they?
Season 2.
Was it Season 2?
Daisy Johnson was featured in Episode 1. She didn't become Quake until much later.
That's what I mean when I say that they weren't featured in the first two seasons. They were in the first two seasons, but... They didn't actually start really incorporating superheroes in the main.
No, but, I mean, they did introduce characters like Deathlok.
Yeah. Deathlok's not really a superhero, but you understand what I mean. There's a difference between a cybernetic human and a superhero or supervillain.
Oh, that's a whole other show.
Yeah, I know.
But, yeah, so I think that's where the longevity's come. It's from seeing... If you like, it's like Avengers behind the scenes.
Yeah.
But we focused for a long time on Marvel and DC.
Yeah.
But, hey, here's a shocker, Rob.
There are others.
There are other comic companies out there.
Yeah. See, here's the thing. And this is where it gets really interesting. When you talk about TV shows based on comics,
yeah,
live action ones, the majority of people will automatically think of shows like Arrow or The Flash or the Marvel stuff. But everyone forgets there's more than one comic book company out there. There's Dark Horse, there's IDW, there's Image, there are a whole host of other companies, and that's not including DC's Vertigo imprint. So you have shows, and the important thing there is that the imprints that are coming from those particular comic book lines, from those publishers, are normally limited runs. They're normally enclosed stories.
Yeah.
So you have stuff like Lucifer and Preacher. I think iZombie as well was based on a comic book as well, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. But I think the one standout one for me, even though I'm not a fan of it, I tried to get into it but couldn't, there are, I would imagine, a lot of individuals out there who are hooked on The Walking Dead who don't realise it's source material.
Yeah.
And that has run, well, from what I can gather from some of the people who watch it, far longer than it should have, and spawned spin-offs.
Yes, it has. Yes, it has. It's spawned a lot of spin-offs. I mean, Riverdale is based on the Archie comics.
Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Yeah, is one. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yep.
The Next Mutation was a live-action kids' TV show, and that's based on it. Witchblade is based on the Mike Turner comics.
Yep.
Although with far less fan service. Thankfully, the Witchblade in the Witchblade TV show didn't feel the need to get her kit off all the time and transform into some spiky, buxom, demonic thing like Mike Turner envisioned her. Thank you, TV show, for not doing that. Powers was another one. Yeah. That one was kind of ill-fated, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I liked the idea of Powers, but... Sorry, not Powers. Powerless is the one that I'm thinking of that was ill-fated, not Powers. Powers was the detective one, wasn't it?
Can't remember. Some of them, I'll be honest, I've read the synopsis and gone, do you know, I don't fancy that.
The Walking Dead is the big one. The Boys is the biggest one of this year, I suppose. Because that one was the one that really put the shock value into these adaptations.
I think the advantage The Boys has got is it has the opportunity to do on TV what Watchmen did in the comics.
Yeah.
All those years ago.
Yeah. I quite liked The Umbrella Academy, right?
Yep.
I thought The Umbrella Academy, and I've said it before, we've said it on the show before, it was the best version of The Dark Phoenix that I've seen in a TV show or in a cartoon, except for the Fox Kids cartoon, because that was really good. But it's the best version of The Dark Phoenix saga in a live-action medium. But then you've got the weird ones, the ones that don't fit into any of those. You know, the ones that don't have superpowers?
The ones that are a bit less superhero would be.
Yeah.
The ones like Wynonna Earp.
Yeah, Wynonna Earp. The End of the Effing World.
Yep.
That's another one that people forget. I mean, there was a pilot of Lock and Key in 2011. Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, was a TV show.
Yep.
That had like two bites at the cherry, didn't it? There was a 1950s one and a, I think, early 2000s. The Tick.
Twice The Tick.
Yeah, exactly. Wasn't there a Van Helsing TV show that was based on the comic?
There is a Van Helsing TV show, yeah. And there is another Lock and Key series coming.
Excellent. But this is the thing. You have so many comics these days. And the thing is, we're just focusing on comics. We haven't even mentioned manga. That's a whole other show on its own.
Again, yeah. I mean, especially through Netflix, it's difficult to tell now when you're looking through some of the preview pictures whether the picture is for an anime or a live action.
Yeah. And that's the problem that we've got. There's so much available now. But I think the biggest thing, though, is that when it comes to live action TV shows, how do you decide which comics to adapt and which ones to leave behind?
First of all, let's have a look at why some TV shows are better adaptations than movies.
Yeah.
I think the thing is, you can tell more of a story over a TV series. Over 10 episodes, you can explore more character interactions and stuff. So I think things like Jessica Jones, where certainly a lot of the Purple Man stuff is all about psychological abuse and that kind of dominant force, you can tell that story and make it more harrowing over the longer form of a 10-episode TV show. If you imagine that first season of Jessica Jones done as a movie, I don't think it would have been quite as appealing.
Yeah.
Simply because there's too many moving parts to keep happy in a sort of hour and a half, 2 hour runtime.
Yeah. If you've got a disconnected narrative, if you've got a comic that isn't connected to any wider universe or anything like that, then it's something that's easily processed, especially if it's a, if it's an enclosed series, if the story's already told, something like Preacher, right?
Yeah.
It's easy for you to produce that, and you can make changes and stuff like that to adapt it to the small screen. That's okay, because at the end of the day, people understand with shows like with stuff like that, you're going to have to make some changes somewhere. As long as you keep the spirit of it, as long as you keep the main points of it. Yeah. But when it comes to stuff where it's connected to a wider narrative universe, like the Marvel stuff, that's where you could run into problems, but you can also run into the ability to introduce other characters who will have their own shows in other shows, like Luke Cage was introduced in Jessica Jones.
Yeah. I think the other thing that the TV medium gives you, which is more flexible, mainly because of the speed of turnaround on a TV show compared to a movie, is you can take time away from the main plot. And how many times have we seen this in these comic book TV shows? I mean, TV in general, but particularly the comic book TV shows, where we go, hey, do you know what? We're going to put a pin in what the main characters are doing.
Yeah.
And we're going to go back 10 years in their life to some other people that had an influence on what they did. Or we're going to just focus on this group of people who will play a part later on. But for now, you just need to introduce them and sow the seeds in people's minds that these are going to feature.
Yeah.
And you can't do that in a movie. You can't just have a scene on its own that is completely unrelated to what went before and what came after. It's all got to sew in somehow.
Yeah.
But you can just do a standalone episode on TV because you've got the flexibility there.
Yeah.
Because if you then start watching it as a whole, you can can that episode and put it in somewhere where it fits better.
I agree. So, okay then, what sort of comics do you think would make good TV shows?
I think the kind of comics that make good TV shows are the ones that have got a rich cast of characters. So I think something like Batman doesn't work as a TV show, or wouldn't work as a modern TV show.
Which is why they had to change it to Gotham.
Yeah, but it doesn't work as a TV show in so much as, if you think back to that 66 series, you watch it on the reruns, how many of those episodes are about the Joker? How many are about Catwoman?
Yeah.
How many are about Penguin?
Yeah.
And then spattered throughout, you've got the odd couple of episodes about the Clock King and Bookworm and stuff like that, Mad Hatter. If you're doing that on a TV show in the modern age where people are binge watching it on a box set type basis, they're going to start skipping over the lower episodes, the sort of the Bookworm episodes and the Condiment King episode. They're going to skip over those because they can.
Mm.
Whereas if you do a series of Batman movies, you know, a trilogy of movies or whatever, you can focus on key villains throughout, and you can do a Joker movie, you can do a Penguin movie, you can do a Catwoman movie, or you can make a real cock-up and put all the villains in one film.
Yeah,
I don't know why, but you could. And I think Suicide Squad, to be fair, would have probably worked better as a TV show, because then you could have taken the time to focus on the individual capabilities of each person. So, in effect, you have a Harley-centric episode, and all the others are the supporting actors for that episode, and then the following week you have a Deadshot episode. The following week you have a Katana episode.
See, basically what you pitch there is the A-Team.
Yeah.
And I actually agree with you. The Suicide Squad should have really been done as an A-Team-style TV series. Because I think there was far too much in the Suicide Squad movie and in the comics for it to be fit into one movie. I don't necessarily think that you have to have a cast of... I say a cast of interesting characters more than a cast of superpowered characters. Then you can basically focus on character interaction to a degree. It's one of the reasons why Smallville worked. And one of the reasons why the early episodes, the first two series of Daredevil worked as well. First season of Punisher, they had one central character, but the people around that character were actually interesting and had stories to tell. And I think that's another way they can do it. And there's loads of comics like
that. I think the reverse is also true, probably for Defenders.
Yeah.
Because that would probably have worked better as an ensemble movie along the lines of The Avengers.
Yes.
Because there wasn't enough story to fill 10 episodes.
No, just a TV movie would have worked for that. I mean, there are characters who I would love to see on TV. Top of the list, I suppose, would be the Savage Dragon.
Okay.
Do you know the Savage Dragon?
I am not familiar with his work. Her work? Their work? I am not familiar with the work of the Savage Dragon. I suspect it may not be suitable for a young audience.
Well, actually, I beg to differ. I think the Savage Dragon could work as a cartoon or as a TV series. See, the Savage Dragon was created by Eric Larson. It's published by Image Comics. And Eric Larson has been doing the Savage Dragon since its creation in 1982.
Okay.
Right. And it's been one author continuously making the Savage Dragon all the way through all this time. So there have been other artists and everything like that, but there's only been one actual writer, and so the story is continuous as well. And what I like about the Savage Dragon is he's a big green guy with a fin on his head. He's basically from another planet. He's accepted into Earth society, and even though he's like Hulk-type strong, he works as a police officer. When he gets into fights, he tries to minimize collateral damage. He tries to protect citizens first before punching the other folks. Do you see what I mean? It's a very different take on the typical kind of superhero ideology that I think would work in a TV show. Maybe a limited run, 6 episodes or something like that.
Yeah.
But I think it could work as a TV show, since we know that alternative takes on the typical superhero ideology and methodology tend to work. So stuff like the Umbrella Academy and The Boys and stuff like that. They've proven that there's an audience for that sort of counterculture, I suppose you'd say, comic book.
Yeah. I think for me, the one that I think would work well as a TV series, because you could do it in a sort of, sort of Miami Vice, NYPD Blue style, is Sin City. Because you could do it like an anthology series.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have to have a regular cast all the time. You could have different people coming in. You could have recurring characters and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, the first movie was an anthology movie, wasn't it?
It was. Well, they both were.
Yeah.
I think the first one pulled it off better because it interwove the stories, whereas the second one divided them up and did them story A, story B, story C, whereas at least on the first one, they sort of wove into each other. But I think that's the beauty. You could do it as standalone little stories where you have half a dozen characters feature every week.
Yeah.
And sometimes you could still have that a bit like League of Gentlemen season 3 had.
Yeah.
Where some of what happens in one person's story is background events in somebody else's. You could still do it that way.
Yeah.
And maybe have a season finale where you see how it all weaves together. But essentially, the little individual Tales from Sin City. You've even titled it.
Tales from Sin City works. See, this is the thing. When you're talking about Sin City itself, you don't have to necessarily stick to what was in the comic books. Right?
No.
you can create new characters and new environments and new instances that are based on the comic books, and maybe you'll have cameos from characters that were in the comic books.
Yeah. But
it's not always necessary. And you can have certain episodes that are based heavily on parts of the comic books, but you don't always need to have that as well. It adds a variety to it. I think that's a great idea. Sin City is a cracking idea. Just don't let Frank Miller near it. you know why. right. Anyway. What other characters who see? The problem I'm having is I'm trying to think of characters outside of Marvel and DC. I think that they could, see, they tried to do a Constantine TV series, and they really could have made it work, but they had the right actor, in my opinion, to play the role of John Constantine.
It did work. They just didn't like it.
That's what I mean.
And they've rescued it. They've rescued the character by putting him into Legends of Tomorrow now.
Yeah. It's just a shame because I think... See, here's the thing. I think that for the character of the Hellblazer, I think they made it too light. I think it needed to be much darker than it was.
I think that one of the reasons they did that was because they wanted to see how it flew first. And I can understand that. They were taking a bit of a risk.
That's the thing. A lot of the people who complained about the TV show are people who would have watched an actual darker version of that show because they were fans of...
Yeah. You've got to remember that from a TV point of view, particularly because I'm not sure what network carried it in the US, but certainly it was Amazon brought it to the UK.
Yeah, true.
They can't rely on just comic book audience numbers. So they couldn't rely on just Constantine fans tuning in.
Yeah.
They needed to be able to attract in. And because it's the supernatural, yes, you're probably going to get some supernatural fans. Not supernatural the show, but, you know, fans of that kind of genre jumping in. But if you make it too dark, it makes it too genre, too niche. You can gradually increase that over time. You've just got to grab that. It's like making a Marvel film that's too sort of history heavy.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to get it. You need to be able to tell people who've never picked up a comic book in their life what the score is.
Okay. This is a topic that we'll obviously revisit at some point. See, the problem is we've got loads of titles, and I think the next time we come back to this, we should focus on non-DC and non-Marvel. There are comics like Astro City and Lumberjanes and, hell, even Fables that I think we could probably talk about. I think Lumberjanes would be easily adapted into a live-action TV show. Astro City has a hell of a lot to offer and a rather large cast of characters. Fables, again, would be pretty easy to adapt.
I would have thought Astro City was probably nailed on for a live action because the way that the rate that they're churning manga-based TV shows out at the minute.
Yeah, unfortunately. But anyway, shall we take a break there?
Yes, let's.
All right. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Sonny Strait, the voice of many of the voices that you grew up on. Yes, I raised all of you ungrateful bastards. And you're listening to The Geek Show. Kamehameha, bitches!
Have you ever been reading through a stack of comics and thought, maybe I should see what this Arkham Asylum game is all about? Or been playing Marvel vs. Capcom and felt like you were at a real disadvantage since you didn't know who half the characters were? Well, Play Comics is the show for you. I'm Chris, and each episode we take a look at video games based on comic properties and how well they stick to that source material. So whether you know the comics and want to know how all these games work, or you know the games and want to find out where all this craziness came from, go check out Play Comics at playcomics.com or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Hello, and welcome back to 4Panel. And now the bit we like, probably the best, which is talking about stuff what we've read. Starting with Rob.
Yes, and you almost forgot what show you were on, didn't you?
I try to, Rob. I try.
Right, okay. I'm going to kick things off today with Volume 3 of Witch Hat Atelier by Kamome Shirahama. And I have to say, the first thing off the bat, The artwork in this continues to be absolutely dyed-in-the-wool gorgeous. I mean, we're talking, like, really, really good character design, really good costuming, really good backgrounds and highly detailed, very expressive characters. I can't really praise this enough, but I am going to continue praising it because you have a continuation of the story. If you remember, at the end of Volume 2, Coco was about to have her mind wiped, her memories removed, including her memories of her mother, by one of the enforcers of the witches who can't stand the old-school witches. They didn't want to wipe out the old type of magic and replace it with this new rules-based system. And so anyone who has done any old-style magic, they would have their memory of magic wiped completely. And Coco doesn't want her memory wiped, and so her teacher intervenes and says, look, she's a student, how is she supposed to cast a spell of this magnitude? So obviously there are things going on. Coco has been selected by a certain old-school witch, and she doesn't even know that she's been selected. She doesn't understand what's going on. She just has nightmares. She stays up awake at night just practicing drawing symbols. She's basically a hard-working apprentice. Meanwhile, her teacher, he's got a score to settle with old-school witches, and he's finally found a link because he got a clue from the incident that happened in the previous volume, and he is working hard to try and follow that trail so he can catch one of the old-school witches because he's got a score to settle. But the real beauty of this manga, right, the real beauty of this story is the fact that there are characters who have their own stories and their own struggles in this who aren't the main characters, but you end up empathizing and sympathizing with those characters because you can understand their situation. Their situations aren't that different from any normal person's. I mean, one kid who, there's an accident at the shop he works at and loads of labels fall off the bottles and he needs some help sorting it all out. And so Coco decides to help him and draws him an actual thing that helps sort out all these different bottles, all these different chemicals into the right order, into what they are. He makes friends and starts respecting Coco after that. But that's only because she's worked so hard and he, at that point, finally realizes that she hasn't fallen into it. She's not privileged or anything like that. She works just as hard as he does to achieve her goals. And so he starts respecting her for that. But the other thing about this is the little nods. Now, everybody talks about Harry Potter, about all these little things in the Harry Potter films and in the Harry Potter stories that separate the magical world from the real world, like platform 13 and a half, was it, at King's Cross Station? And
9 3/4.
Was it 9 3/4?
9 3/4, something like that.
I can't remember. But in this, there are little things that I love seeing. Coco and Kifri, her teacher, they go to visit the ink shop where she bought her special ink to draw symbols. But there's a blank wall. And she goes, the door's gone. Kifri goes, damn it, it must be closed. And then the boy who works in the shop, he turns up. He's like, oh, you're looking for Grandpa? And they're like, yeah. He goes, well, okay, I'll let you in. And he takes out a door handle from his bag, attaches it to the wall and turns the handle and a door opens. Coco's like, oh, wow, I didn't expect the shop to be like this. He goes, no, this is the basement. Different rooms have different handles. So he's basically carrying around a bag of door handles that open into different parts of the building.
Right.
It's a great idea, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And it's little ideas like that that I love seeing in this manga. Just loads of little ideas about magic and how it's applied, and it continues to be a really interesting, really fascinating story with fantastic artwork and some brilliant characters, really complex, really deep characters as well. It's not just Coco, it's Kifri, it's everybody. They've all got their own stories to tell, and their stories are fascinating. And I have to say, I absolutely adore this. I think it's one of the best manga that I've read so far.
Whatever.
Yeah.
And you've read lots of manga.
I've read hundreds.
Wow.
Which, I had to tell you, I'm only at volume 3, and unless something serious happens and it really takes a drop in quality, it's on course to at least be in my top 20 of all time.
And that's all any manga author can ask for.
Considering I have only rated 2 manga as masterpieces in my entire life.
Ooh.
And I've read something along the lines of, when I say hundreds, I don't mean low hundreds. I mean something like 900, probably more, manga.
You need to get out more.
You're not the first to tell me that. Anyway, Mick.
Yes. Well, and this is the part where you'll need to insert some 1970s sitcom music.
I'm glad you said sitcom music.
Well, like, I don't know, a 70s sitcom, something like Terry and June.
Oh, yes.
Because that's right. It's time for another hilarious episode of Meet the Skrulls. Meet the Skrulls is a Marvel comic which, when handed to me for review, I thought, oh my God, this is going to be terrible.
Yeah,
this is going to be one of those times when Marvel have thought, do you know what, be funny, without actually understanding what funny means. But it's actually much, much better than I could ever have hoped for. What Meet the Skrulls does is it takes us through the life of a family of Skrulls who are on a mission. And it's like a dark version of Third Rock from the Sun, in that they're a family that have been sent to Earth with specific missions, and they've all been given assignments, and they live as a family, the Warner family. And Mum is assistant to a congresswoman. Dad works at Stark Industries, or Stark Unlimited, I think it is now. And the two kids go to their respective schools with a task to befriend the daughters of high-ranking individuals. And so it's their secret mission is to infiltrate and affect the direction of S.H.I.E.L.D. related research and Stark Industries related research, and make sure that certain technologies, certain anti-Skrull technologies, don't see the light of day. And so what we do is we follow the fact that they're doing this, but also we follow the fact that they are a family, that they have got a teenage daughter, they have got a preteen daughter. They do have arguments about how that daughter gets away with this, but that one doesn't. They have arguments about who's pulling their weight and who's doing the right thing. There's even intimation that maybe one of the parents has had to be in flagrante with someone as part of the mission. And so you get this intergalactic bickering between the family. In the meantime, they've got their superior Skrull officer breathing down their neck saying things are going wrong. What's happening here? What happened to so-and-so? How did this get stopped? How did you manage to screw that bit up? And if you're not careful, you'll be pulled off this mission and given a different one. And despite all the Warner's best efforts, these things still keep going wrong until they figure out why. And I'm not going to say any more because that'll spoil it. But needless to say, there is a twist. And It was far more complex than I gave it credit for. I thought, and we said this quite a bit in the live TV show bit, but I thought it was going to be another episode of Marvel 90210, but it wasn't. It was quite enjoyable, and the twist made it even more so. And it kind of follows that sort of humanization of the Skrulls that you got in Captain Marvel. And Endgame.
Okay.
And it's an amusing diversion.
You don't mean Endgame, you mean Far From Home.
Far From Home, sorry. Yeah. Yes, that humanization that started in it starts at the end of Endgame, I guess.
No, it doesn't. It starts in Captain Marvel.
Which is before Endgame, not Far From Home.
Yeah, and then it continues in Far From Home. The Skrulls aren't in Endgame, are they? They're in Far From Home.
No. I can't remember. It's been so long since I watched a film.
But you enjoyed Meet the Skrulls, and that's the important thing.
Yes. Can I go home now?
You are home. Right, okay.
Can I go to someone else's home?
Right. I'm going to round off with Mr. and Mrs. X, Gambit and Rogue Forever, which collects Mr. and Mrs. X numbers 7 to 12 by Kelly Thompson, Oscar Basaldúa, Javier Pina, and Frank DeMata. Right.
Basaldúa, wasn't that a mine in Lord of the Rings?
I think so. Anyway, this starts off with Rogue and Gambit, and they are hanging upside down over a pit of crocodiles, because that's how you start any Rogue and Gambit story, it seems.
Okay.
So anyway, Rogue and Gambit, if you remember the last Mr. and Mrs. X, they got married. They got hitched. They are officially man and wife. And the unfortunate thing is their honeymoon was kind of interrupted by a clone of Rogue, if I remember rightly, Deadpool, who used to date Rogue and was insistent on being the third wheel, and various other, I think the Shi'ar were chasing them as well because of various things. The clone of Rogue was, I think, the Shi'ar Empress or the new Shi'ar Empress or something like that. But anyway, now they've been captured by Mojo. And when I say Mojo, I don't mean the aniseed-flavoured chews from when I was a kid. And I also don't mean Mojo Jojo from the Powerpuff Girls. This is Mojo from X-Men. You know, the big Jabba the Hutt type thing on the mechanical spider legs who runs Mojo World and is obsessed with TV shows.
Can I just point out that I really hate you now?
Why?
Because up to that point, I didn't know anything about the Powerpuff Girls.
Anyway. Mojo's not happy about the fact that Remy and Rogue are hanging upside down over a pit of crocodiles. He's like, no, look, I wanted heat. This isn't heat. A pit of crocodiles is basically so yesterday. Why don't we throw something else in? I love the descriptions it gives to the characters. It says, Mojo, despot of the Mojoverse, prone to drama. Spiral, sorceress and intergalactic teleporter / time traveler, slave of Mojo. Major Domo, right-hand man and official toady butt munch of Mojo.
Okay.
Because that's how you describe right-hand characters these days. So anyway, Mojo has this wheel of genres, and he keeps spinning the wheel to try and find a good genre for a story involving Rogue and Gambit. And so the first story didn't work, so he goes on to the next story, which is Honeymoon Lighting. Remember Moonlighting? You know the Bruce Willis one?
I do.
Yeah, it's kind of a noir version of that called Honeymoon Lighting.
Okay.
Which ends with Rogue killing Gambit by absorbing all his powers and life force, everything like that. Then it shifts on to what is basically the Sleeping Beauty, I would assume, but with the hero being Longshot rather than Gambit, but then Gambit invades that particular narrative. The story continues on with various things happening, and there are so many stories, but in every story, in every genre, Rogue ends up killing Gambit, and she's killed Gambit loads and loads of times, and they're trying to figure out what's going on. Spiral has had enough, meanwhile. She's tired of being Mojo's slave, and so she rescues Gambit and says, you're a thief, I want you to steal something for me. It's a very important thing for me, so you go steal it, and I'll go save your wife. So he agrees, and he goes to steal whatever it is, and also becomes a revolutionary in the process. Meanwhile, Rogue is coming to terms with her powers and why her powers work the way they do. And it's interesting, that angle, because this actually looks at the psychology of Rogue as a character to a degree, and it kind of breaks down the reason why her powers are the way they are, and actually gives a logical explanation as to why she has that particular, why she can absorb people's powers and abilities and life force and stuff like that. It explains why she doesn't turn it off, why she's not able to touch anyone, things like that. And it gives a logical explanation to that, which I really appreciated, because the rest of this comic is kind of Fruit Loops. You've got Mojo, who is one of the more bizarre X-Men villains.
Okay.
You've got Rogue, who's basically had a power-up, effectively. You've got Gambit, who also has had a power-up for some reason. You've got Spiral, who basically is in the process of trying to gain her freedom. You've got the two of them having a nice, quiet evening in, and then going out to do their thing because Gambit's dad turns up and says, we got to go back to New Orleans, there's trouble. Meanwhile, you remember that Captain Marvel re-entry?
Yeah.
That you covered last week. This actually crosses over a little bit with that because Rogue gets a phone call from Carol Danvers and she's asking for help, something that's happening on Roosevelt Island.
Right.
Which crosses over with Captain Marvel re-entry.
It does.
And so Rogue's off to do that. Meanwhile, Remy travels to New Orleans to sort stuff out and ends up falling foul of the Thieves Guild, the Assassins Guild, and everyone else. And then stuff happens. And when I said this is Fruit Loops, I meant exactly what I said. This storyline at the end here, it doesn't make any sense as to why it's there. I don't understand why it's there. I'm sitting there going, okay, you could have just ended this with them going off her to help Captain Marvel and Remy just let him go for a bagel or something. I don't know. Let him have breakfast at the very least. You don't have to drag him off all the way to New Orleans. I have to say, Mr. and Mrs. X continues to be a fun comic book. Okay, there are odd things that happen in there, and there are some things that really make no sense. They're the lighter moments of it. There are some dark moments in there, but I think in general it maintains that light tone. And I think that the relationship between Gambit and Rogue is always an interesting relationship because the two of them have basically played around and they've danced around each other for decades. But now they're an actual married couple. And what I'd like to see, because they're calling it Mr. and Mrs. X, what I'd like to see going forward from this is the two of them adjusting to married life in the same way that we saw Spider-Woman adjusting her superhero outings to actually being a parent.
Right.
Because that was one of the more interesting things about Spider-Woman was they basically had her pregnant as a superhero, and then after the baby was born, she was adjusting to being a parent and a superhero as well. And you also had kind of an addition to that was Jessica Jones and Luke Cage being superheroes and parents as well. Do you see what I mean? I think it sounds weird, but I like seeing a bit more mundanity in my comics involving superpowered beings because it makes the superpowers that little bit more spectacular when they come out.
Yeah, I guess. It gives it a bit of a counterpoint, doesn't it?
Yeah, it kind of grounds it a little bit. So that's
so watch out for Rob's next comic, Spider-Man Pays His Mortgage.
No, it won't be Spider-Man. He'll be
Spider-Woman applies for tax credits.
No. Not even that.
Hulk takes his driving theory test.
You're forgetting just how my brain works. I didn't go to Spider-Man Pays His Mortgage. I went straight to Spider Accountant. I went straight to a guy on the ceiling doing other people's taxes, never mind his own.
Dear, oh dear, oh dear.
Exactly. Oh, and I have to say, my spider accountant is chartered. So anyway, we are at the end of the show. So we're going to leave you there for this week. If you want to catch any of our previous episodes, you'll find them all on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, along with all of the other shows that make up the Geek Show podcast family. There's also various videos from YouTube, reviews, and various other things as well. And you'll also find our Patreon and our shop on our site as well. If you're listening as a podcast through any kind of podcast service like Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify, Deezer, Stitcher, whatever, leave us a rating, leave us a review. It does help us with exposure and it does help us improve. And that's it from us until next time. I've been Rob.
I've been Mick.
And we will see you all later.
Thanks for listening.